You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of November 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, we'll find out whether Donald Trump is ready to soften his past tone about one of his favorite publications.
The story was a fraud and a big embarrassment to the New York Times. And it was a big front page story. Front page, center, color picture, a disgrace.
My guests Martin Plaut and Alessio Patalano will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including what Trump's presidency might mean for the United States' relationship with Africa, what Japan and South Korea might be able to tell each other about North Korea that both don't already know, and national debts. At what point do numbers get so big as to become meaningless? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Alessio Patalano, lecturer in war studies at King's College London, and Martin Plaut, journalist and fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies at the University of London. Welcome both. And we will start in the United States, where President-elect Donald Trump has taken time out from tweeting abuse at the failing, nasty, and not nice New York Times to drop in on the New York Times, which he subsequently described as a great, great American jewel, a world jewel. The Times, unlike the broadcasters who had previously visited Trump Tower, insisted that the discussion be on the record, and the transcript amounts to what may be the fullest picture we yet have of Trump's thinking, such as it may be on key issues. Martin, first of all, there's always the big question with any, I guess, public statement by Donald Trump, given his long record for saying pretty much whatever pops into his head at any given moment. How much of any of this can we take seriously?
I don't think a great deal, because, you know, in a sense, he's not somebody who really is that interested for very long about anything. So, yes, it is what he's thinking at the moment. He'll put a lot of people in place who will actually do most of the work. He's a chief executive. That's the way that he's going to run it. But I think there was somebody said, and it's certainly not my idea, that the media and the intelligentsia, and I dare say that includes you, Andrew, I don't know under which category, took him literally but not seriously, while his own supporters took him seriously but not literally.
Indeed.
And I think that is the clue to Mr. Trump. So, you know, yes, they know the general direction he's going in, and if he wants to flatter the New York Times for a moment, he will do so. But, you know, tomorrow he'll have a different idea. So what the heck? Why take it so seriously?
Alessio, is that what he was doing? Was he just playing to his audience, as we've seen him do, you know, with obvious success on the campaign trail? Because what struck me about the interview was that he seems to have spent an hour basically sort of doing 180-degree reverses on everything he promised during the campaign. He said he wouldn't prosecute the Clintons. He said he wasn't interested in torture. He said he disavowed and condemned his alt-right and or neo-Nazi followers. He didn't mention the war along the Rio Grande. Is that just what he does? Does he just size up a room, size up an audience, figure out what they want to hear and then tell them?
To an extent. I think there's two components to this story. One is campaigning is finished, and his campaigning was designed to stir up debates whereby he would not contribute, if you want, proactively. He would let other people do the debate for him. And then he would jump in with a couple of tweets now and then and take the conversation somewhere else. So if you want, there was a lot of shouting during the campaign, of which some of this proclamation were a tactical component, if you allow me to say that. But now that campaigning is finished, right? So this is not more time for this time of tactics. Now is time to start building, if you want, the new picture. Not the picture of the shouting candidate who's the anti-establishment. The picture to build is that of the next president of the United States. And in his mind, that means the person, as you say, kid that will bring everybody together, the chief executive, the guy that nobody ever is sort of angered against because he's the guy that brings everyone together. So what he's doing, and he's been doing this for the past 2 weeks, is going around and trying to rebuild bridges that he had sort of violently torched during the campaign, not even burned in that sense. And, you know, and the New York Times, it's one of the places to start because there's a few other outlets that came on top of the list of the shouting whenever it was criticizing the media. So I think in this respect, if we leave the content on the side, and I have a line on the content in a moment, but if we're looking at how this interview fits into the character, it's perfectly consistent with his character. It's just that he's now set on a different type of modality that is no longer the campaign modality. It is building up the picture of the next president.
Martin, what did you make of the tone of the conversation? Were the New York Times being appropriately respectful to the president-elect or too friendly by half, did you think?
Well, you know, I suppose they were a bit overcome by the fact that he actually said yes and then said yes that he'd stay on the record.
So there was some doubt about that for a while. He appeared at one point that he was going to flounce and then he unflounced.
But don't you think that that's perhaps the secret of Mr. Trump, is that he likes to keep his opponents and even his friends off balance. Mm. So he never quite makes it clear what the heck he really thinks. He gives the idea that you know where he is, but without making it very sure. And it's a tactic quite a few leaders have used in the past, the uncertainty principle. And that is what he does. He engenders the uncertainty in you. You don't know whether he's going to come, is he going to go, is he going to do the deal, is he not going to do the deal, has he walked out the door but actually will come back in again. That's the kind of man he is. And, you know, I mean, the most extraordinary thing is that his remarks, in a sense, where he talked about, you know, he can run his business perfectly and run the United States perfectly. At the same time, there's no clash of interests. You know, I'll do deals. It'll be fine.
Well,
What's the problem?
It appears that he already has been in his conversations with global leaders, sort of, you know, trying to do deals from the perspective now of the president.
Well, he nearly tried to do a deal with giving us a new ambassador.
Yes, that offer does appear to have been fairly unequivocally rejected. But Alessio, what did you make of that? He used a somewhat Nixonian phrase when he said the president can't have a conflict of interest, and by that I think we are clear that he didn't mean that the president must be clear of conflicts of interest. I think he meant that if the president's doing it, by definition, it isn't.
No, I think is exactly what you just said. I think that's the way he's looking at it. And if we observe, I mean, the interesting thing about the transcript is that the New York Times also produces some sort of a fact box with a summary, and the summary is about six lines. Interestingly enough, that's pretty much about in terms of content you can get out of the entire transcript, which is 40 pages. That in itself says everything you want to know about the question of how he is approaching this. And again, what was interesting is that on every single issue, you said at the beginning quite eloquently that it was doing a reverse at 180 degrees on pretty much every issue. But if you actually read the final statement of every single topic, the expression used would be, I'll look into it, I'm paying close attention to it. There was absolutely nothing that would define a particular position on that specific issue.
And again, uncertainty principle again.
Absolutely, completely. I think Martin is absolutely right. And in that sense, the Nixonian use of the language, as in, you know, by definition it can be, well, it could mean anything really. I leave it up to you guys to define it, and whichever way it's more convenient for me on that particular day on the spot, that's exactly where I stand. And that's exactly, you know, from my point of view, the biggest takeaway. The transcript, it's either a stroke of genius of English language in the way it portrays ambiguity, but it's also an insult to the English language because apparently there is not one single sentence that goes past four words, which is very strange.
That's been a motif of his entire campaign. Final thought before we move on, Martin, on developments in the United States. There's some suggestions floating around on possibly the more optimistic corners of the media, saying that the election results in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania and Michigan should have a long, hard look taken at them. Suggestions of hacking may have tipped the balance against Clinton. Is there anything... I mean... even if that's true at this point, is it politically possible to seriously raise a fuss about this?
You know, I don't think so. And I think that partly one can see the fight has gone out of Hillary.
Mm.
You know, when she could hardly get the courage to walk out the front door and, you know, go and have a walk anymore. I mean, you know, she really, really has. She is now in the past tense. And, you know, it would require every ounce of energy and courage of her and the Democratic Party to really launch a campaign to get this unpicked. Because, you know, people just, they wouldn't stand for it, I don't think. But I'm not an expert on American systems.
Well, let's look further afield now. And while Americans continue to adjust to the idea of President-elect Donald Trump, some of our listeners may be more acclimatized to the idea of government by a thin-skinned, bellicose demagogue with a relaxed approach to conflicts of interest and a fondness for gold-plated bathroom fittings. In portions of Africa, for example, President Donald Trump's style of leadership will not seem an unusual proposition. It remains to be seen whether Trump intends to exploit this familiarity. However, as we go to air, Trump is believed to have spoken to 29 foreign national leaders, not one of them from sub-Saharan Africa. Martin, a little over 8 years ago, I was in sub-Saharan Africa, specifically Ethiopia, where there was extraordinary excitement and anticipation about the idea of Barack Obama's election. There were posters of him on every stationary object in Addis Ababa, pretty much. How will the mood now compare with the mood then across Africa, with all due recognition that it is a vast and diverse continent?
Quite. Always bearing that in mind, I think that, you know, the vast majority of people are interested in it. Everyone is fascinated around the world in Mr. Trump. And, yeah, you know, all the African leaders have made all the appropriate noises. I think it was Ms. Nkurunziza of Burundi said that Trump's victory was a victory for all Americans and a certain improvement in relations was going to happen. I mean, I don't think they believe a word of this. But, you know, it's just the sort of guff that you come out with when the boss walks into the room, you stand up and doff your cap. And I think they know that he's the boss. I mean, to be honest with you, the person who really, really stood up for Africa, bizarrely, was President Bush. Who produced AGOA, and that produced a lot of trade. And, you know, frankly, President Obama was a big disappointment.
We shall come back to that. But, Alessio, I was looking through some of the responses to which Martin alluded of reactions by African leaders to Donald Trump's election. The ones that struck me as most enthusiastic, apart from Mr. Nkurunziza in Burundi, were Idris Deby in Chad, Salva Kiir in South Sudan, and Joseph Kabila in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Basically, your 21st century iterations of your traditional African strongman figure. What does that tell us?
Oh, tell us something about a certain return. Oh, by the way, I should the disclaimer now is blinking that this section of the discussion is not politically correct for all those who are listening at the other end of the spectrum. Because I think what we should be talking about is the return of degree of machismo, and I think The Economist call it the return of machismo in international politics. And you can see around the globe there is almost a crave for this strong man that delivers this absolute outrageous lines, and they have a behavior.
Vladimir Putin being another obvious example.
Oh, yes, of course, but it's not the only one. You got Erdogan, you got Duterte. I mean, you got
indeed
plenty,
so.
You got plenty of these characters going on around. And in this respect, I think Trump trumps them all, dare I say, because it brings together all these different features, at least on paper. In practical terms, frankly, contrary to everybody else, he's been changing his opinion quite quickly on most subjects. And whilst it was extremely controversial until a couple of weeks ago, now it's controversial because he's trying to reject and deny the type of controversies that he was trying to sort of build up before the election, whereas most of these other leaders have actually been very consistent with the way they've been proceeding and not only projecting themselves, but acting politically. Nonetheless, he has all the sort of physical and persona charismatic features that would speak to the strengths of these type of characters, these type of leaders that see sort of almost an autocratic whether it is knighted or dictatorial, that's a different story, but autocratic style, projecting their power and persona across the political spectrum to move a country forward.
Martin, if we're going to have a bash at being optimistic here, and just for fun, let's try that. If it turns out that President Donald Trump actually is remotely interested in sub-Saharan Africa, and there is so far absolutely no indication that this is the case, but is it arguable that because he comes across as your typical sort of, you know, macho, blowhard strongman, that he might actually get on better with other macho, blowhard strongmen than the rather more urbane Barack Obama did?
It's possible. I mean, I gather one of the great tasks that the American president has to perform is to stand for ages shaking people's hands and getting a photograph with them one after another as they pass through Washington. And I cannot imagine how he's going to put up with that, because he would loathe it. But anyway, let's leave that to one side. You know, I think the great problem is that although I said that Obama really hasn't taken a big interest in Africa, the one thing that has happened in the last few years, and it's been a major change, is the growth of the foreign bases, and particularly American foreign bases in Africa, and the move to counter global terrorism as the Americans see it. So whether it is from Djibouti to tackle al-Shabaab, or Mali and Niger to tackle Boko Haram and the other Islamist groups in the Sahara, there has been a big development. Now, is Donald Trump going to agree to allow AFRICOM to continue to expand its network of military activity across Africa? It's done very, very quietly, but it is very real. And I don't know the answer to that question. But, you know, is he going to be somebody who takes the war on terrorism seriously? That is going to be a key question.
If I may, on this particular point, it seems to me that all the sort of people that he's looking at to have in his cabinet would suggest as much. Or certainly that the focus, I mean, put it this way, from the East Asian perspective, from the Asia-Pacific perspective, I think if we look at his statements, the people he's sort of creating, the team he's building up around him, the so-called rebalancing towards the Pacific seems to be, from that perspective, the least of his concerns. Because there is not single top Asia person or person with extensive experience. And as you correctly pointed out, there's been such a concentration of capabilities, forces, and sheer power in the sort of African Middle Eastern context. And the people that he's bringing on board have an expertise in that area, in those regional spaces. It seems to me that if any guess should be made, certainly would be that the focus will remain in this part of the world, that is, in between sort of sub-Saharan Africa and sort of North African Middle East, that area, rather than continuing on what had been the sort of the big ticket rebalancing to the Asia Pacific.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Alessio Patalano and Martin Plaut. Coming up next, the one thing South Korea and Japan agree on, i.e. that there's someone they both dislike even more than each other.
Monocle invites you to raise a glass of Glühwein at the annual Monocle Christmas Market. Please join us for this winter wonderland of a weekend, complete with warming treats from the Monocle Cafe, reindeer petting, and an appearance from Monochan the Owl, all set to a cheery playlist. You can also try your hand at our ever-popular tombola and meet our VIP Santa Claus all the way from Rovaniemi. The 2016 Monocle Christmas Market on Saturday the 3rd and Sunday the 4th of December from 11 a.m. to 1700 at our Midori House HQ here in Marylebone. Find all the details at monocle.com. We ho ho, hope to see you there.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Alessio Patalano and Martin Plaut. Now, the equation that holds that the enemy of one's enemy is by definition one's friend is a dangerous logical fallacy. But if one has to share a neighbourhood with North Korea, it's easy to see the appeal of it. Japan and South Korea, two countries which generally cannot stand each other, have overcome their mutual resentment to sign a military intelligence pact which will enable better sharing of information about Pyongyang's nuclear and missile capabilities. Alessio, the question that strikes me, and it's possibly unanswerable, for which apologies in advance, but what would South Korea or Japan know that the other one doesn't?
They do have a different, a very complementary way of gathering intelligence and information over North Korea. So, for the records, this is going to be a really optimistic sound. I mean, you know, Andrew, you said you were optimistic, but you didn't sound too much on this one. But really, I think we should try to point out a couple of things. First of all, Japan's signal intelligence, satellite intelligence, is I think a couple of notches above on the capabilities of the South Koreans, whereas the South Koreans do have much a better human intelligence and information. Now, up until now, in particular, so far as North Korea is concerned, the funny thing would have been a situation by which Tokyo and Seoul would talk to each other through Washington. And this went, you know, all sorts of possible things. For example, some of the latest reincarnations of the trilateral exercises would actually be a double bilateral. So you'd see the Korean and American bits with Korean Americans together and the Japanese physically leaving the room, and then the Japanese and the American bits with the Americans and Japanese talking to each other and the Koreans leaving the room. So what this document really does is two things. First, it starts to removing barriers that, whilst politically understandable for the animosity that exists between the two countries, made absolutely no sense whatsoever in a context whereby South Korea and Japan are the closest partners of the United States in that part of the world. And on a second level, it is very important so far as the monitoring of the evolution and transformation of the capabilities in North Korea, both missiles and nuclear, in terms of producing some sort of better picture, awareness of where they are and where they're going. So in this respect, this is actually a very good thing because it will allow them to have better integration across the spectrum of intelligence machineries that are very complementary with each other.
I mean, Martin, for better or for worse, is there a straw in the wind here? I mean, Alessio is painting a picture there of, you know, South Korea and Japan basically using Washington as a translator when they need to talk to each other, which is an obviously ludicrous situation. But if countries which have been traditionally hostile to each other, but both allies of the United States, have to get on board with the idea that the United States may be a more insular or less reliable ally, are we likely to see more of these kinds of rebalancings as countries realize we actually have to find a way to talk to each other?
I mean, it's certainly a possibility. I mean, there are, you know, how is America going to, for example, relate to Britain on the one hand and the EU on the other if Britain is outside of the EU and the whole relationship with NATO is now clearly up for grabs? But I mean, you know, the other question I would ask Alessio, I mean, since you know this is your area really, is, you know, how does this all then relate to the ongoing problem with China in the South China Sea? Because I mean, you know, they both have an interest in that, and how's that going to work?
No, I think you're absolutely right. There's a number of so before answering to this question, I think the point that you're making, Andrew, is very important. I think that in the uncertainty that this new administration is creating, particularly in certain parts of the world where there's lots of security issues that are and security questions that are unanswered, of which the South China Sea is one of them, the local regional actors will have to start reviewing and considering some of their options. And again, even in the context of South Korea and Japan, which, if you want to, historically, it's not always been that bad. This is very much a post-1990s sort of deterioration of the relationship. Certainly, this is one aspect that we're looking at. And insofar as the South China Sea is concerned, of course, I think it has become it's going to be very interesting to see actors like the Philippines and Vietnam, who have been at the forefront of the South China Sea tensions, how these countries will react depending on the kind of offer that the American administration will present to them in terms of their relationship with China. If we're looking at what is happening at the moment between South Korea and Japan, I think South Korean President Ms. Park is going through this terrible moment. You know, she's indicted. She's got all sorts of bad things happening to her. There is like protests of hundreds of thousands of people in Seoul. People want her to resign. But at the same time, insofar as the relationship with China, we're still looking at the situation that is very tense. So turns out answered that in these conditions, it was ideal for her to turn around and say, you know, it can't be any bad than this. You know, it couldn't go any worse than this. So, yeah, let's deal with this problem with Japan and move on, because this is about the right time to do so. I think we'll see more of this happening in the future.
Okay, well, finally tonight here in the UK, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, has made an autumn statement, the headline figure of which is that due to the whole taking back control thing, the country will be £122 billion worse off in 2020 than previously predicted. Even this fantastic figure, however, pales next to the UK's national debt, currently somewhere in the vicinity of £1.6 trillion, or a bit over 25,000 quid for every person resident on these islands. Martin, how much have you got on you?
Nearly as much as that, but not quite. For my money, the most interesting thing that came out of the budget was, in fact, tucked away, I think it is table B1 in the budget responsibility output, which points out that the cost of Brexit, they've had a stab at getting what this will be, over the next 5 years will be £58 billion. All the experts who were poo-pooed in the past before the actual vote took
place. Does that work out
as
better or worse than the 350 million quid a week on the side of the bus?
Oh, it certainly works out as worse. Because, you know, all the experts who were questioned and made their points during the referendum pointed out that this would be an extremely difficult and very, very expensive issue if we went down the road. And here we are. We now have the bill. £58 billion over the next 5 years. That's what it's going to cost us.
If only somebody had warned them that this would be an expensive and complicated pain in the neck with almost no appreciable upside. Alessio, how big a problem is it that people that passed, and I suffer from this myself, that past a certain point, numbers become kind of meaningless, don't they?
Absolutely. I think we've seen this already during the last 2-3 weeks running up to the referendum, where you had pretty much any respectable think tank or major university with an EU outfit putting out numbers that were absolutely scary, right? But not even to this level, actually. They still were like big warning signs suggesting this is really not a good idea, and economically,
yeah, exactly,
it's just madness. And you could see people just turning around and saying, yeah, but we really don't want immigrants, we really don't like the EU, so we're going to go and do this anyway, because they felt reassured by Boris Johnson going out and saying, like, oh, Britain is going to be a global brand and we're going to do just fine. And that was about it. You know, when this is the best answer to, like, numbers calculated, says everything about the fact that you're absolutely right in that sense.
I mean, do you think there's a problem as well, not just, and I think it's true that past a certain figure, I mean, you know, we're told today that the hole in the budget between now and 2020 will be 122 billion quid, which is a lot of money. But if they'd said it's 132 billion pounds, that wouldn't really have made any difference to the way the news is received. And obviously 10 billion quid is an absolutely colossal sum of money.
Yeah, I mean, that is the problem with the numbers. And the other thing is the dog that didn't bark in all of this. I mean, we are going into winter now. There is a crisis in almost every hospital in the country. And yet in 51 minutes, Mr. Hammond didn't say one thing about the National Health Service. Now, this is an absolutely bedrock institution, and he has nothing to say about it. I suppose because he has no money to give it.
I mean, Alessio, is there anything that can actually be done about this? Do we need to rethink education from a very early age in economics and stuff? Because this is the thing that strikes me about the referendum in particular, that people just didn't really have any comprehension of the consequences.
That is certainly true to an extent. I think the problem with these statistics is that they needed to have some sort of meaning that people can relate to. The problem is not the stats themselves, is that if they are pronounced in a vacuum, they just don't have any sense. You know, it's like saying there's 1 million refugees going out of Syria every year. You know, you should say it's a city the size of Manchester. People would probably relate to that much more.
Alessio Patilano and Martin Plaut, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Daphne Karnizes. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Music next, 1900, it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli, and there'll be more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.